Thank you, Benita. My name is Ed Arnold, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Good morning, everybody, and I'm from Albany, Georgia. I'm a member of the Central Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Albany, and that's the way we say it, Albany. I married a woman from Detroit, Michigan, and she tried to set me straight. She said, it's Albany. So when we moved to that area about 9 years ago, we were in town. We pulled in a Dairy Queen, and I thought, I'll just settle this once and for all. I asked the girl that took our order, I said, would you please tell my wife how to pronounce the name of this place? She said, Dairy Queen. I want to thank the committee and Groves in particular for the invitation to be with you this morning. When I first met Groves Cartledge, I thought he was one of the kindest, most gentle men I'd ever met. I've come to realize this weekend that he's vicious and he's cruel. Anybody that would schedule a fellow to come and speak at his very first roundup on Sunday morning and have to follow Jack Sullivan on Saturday night is mean. That's cruel and unusual punishment. I wanted to go home last night. My wife did this morning, by the way. Is Jerry Dale here? Jerry was the guy that wasn't here last night that won the umbrella for the closest to the pen, and some of you didn't understand what I meant when I said that he deserved the umbrella for the longest drive, too. I want to thank Jerry this morning for the tour of North Georgia that I got yesterday morning. Totally unsolicited. Jerry was going to take me over to the golf course, which is 5-6 miles from Cartersville. We left at 8:10. We got there at 9:10. We toured Rock Mart and Dallas and finally found the golf course. And I want to thank Jerry Barber for the good time on the golf course yesterday. Jerry was in a group that was playing behind me. I want to make a suggestion to him, however, with deer season coming upon us, it might serve you well to get you an orange vest, Jerry. Somebody's going to shoot you in those woods. I also want to thank Bo Welch. I had on my name tag Leesburg, Georgia. I got tired of telling people I was from Albany. First thing they want to know is, do you know Bo Welch? And I started saying, Bo who? But Bo is largely responsible for me being here today, me being sober today. Took me under his wing when I first came to this program. Taught me a lot and showed me a lot by the example that he set before me. I asked Bo, I said, Bo, you know, this is my first roundup talk, and you go all over the place talking in front of crowds and all like that. What's the last thing you do before you get up to speak? I thought he'd tell me some secret prayer that he made, you know, and tell me something really profound that I could use this morning. He said, I go empty my bladder. I told you I was an alcoholic. I also want to get something straight up first. I heard somebody in the bathroom a while ago said, you know the speaker this morning? The other guy said, no, but I heard he's a damn Baptist preacher. And I was in the stall behind the door, and I wouldn't even come out for 5 minutes. I am a preacher, but contrary to what some people think, I didn't enter the ministry because of some egotistical urge to be in front of the public. The truth is, I felt called into the ministry. I knew I was called because I woke up one morning craving fried chicken and didn't want to go to work. And I knew I was called immediately to be a Baptist. That's what I became. And I used to send people to AA, never thought I would end up here myself. I could visualize myself on Sunday morning speaking to a crowd like this in church, but not at a AA meeting. We Baptists, you know, we don't believe in making it, we don't believe in buying it, we don't believe in selling it, and we don't believe in drinking it. And I was somewhat reluctant to come here and tell everybody I was a Baptist preacher. I got here, I found out there's quite a few of us around here, you know. Louis Grizzard says we're getting better. At least we speak to each other at the liquor store now. I heard about these three fellows were discussing their dad's wealth. One was a lawyer's kid and a doctor's kid and a Baptist preacher's kid. Lawyer kid said, my dad's the wealthiest man in town. Said he owns a whole city block. Doctor's kid said, that's nothing. My daddy's richer than that. He owns two city blocks. Baptist preacher kid said, that's nothing. My daddy is richer than both your daddies put together. Because he owns hell. The two boys said, no, nobody owns hell. He said, my dad does. I heard him tell Mama last night the deacons gave it to him. If that's true, I own part of it myself. I heard about this couple that had spent all their life working and never taking any time for themselves. They'd spent all they had on the children and grandkids, and they were nearing retirement, and what they decided to do was a dream that they'd had for years, and that's buy them a tent and just travel across country camping out. And not having ever done this before, they wanted to find out as much about these campgrounds as they could. And one of the primary concerns of the lady of the house was that they had proper toilet facilities. And the only way she knew to find out was just write the manager of the first campground that they planned to stay in. When it came time to write that word toilet, which is nothing wrong with that word, she was just such a proper, dignified type lady. She just couldn't find it in her heart to write the word toilet. So she said, I'll just write bathroom commode. Then she couldn't spell commode, and that still sounded a little bit crude to her. She said, I'll just abbreviate. She'll ask him, do you have a BC on the campground? And he'll know what I mean. The manager got the letter, and he read it and couldn't figure out what she meant. And he shared it with some other people in the office, and they passed it around, put their heads together, and decided what the lady was asking was, do you have a Baptist church on the ground? So he sat down and wrote her a letter that I'm going to read to you. He wrote her back, dear friend, I regret very much the delay in answering your letter, but I take great pleasure in telling you the BC is located 9 miles from the campground and is capable of seating 250 people. This is very unfortunate indeed if you're in the habit of going regularly. But no doubt you'll be interested to know a great number of people take a lunch and make a day of it. They usually arrive early and stay late. The last time I went was 6 years ago, and I had to stand up the whole time. It may interest you to know that a fund drive has been started to raise money to buy new seats. I would like to say it pains me very much not to be able to go more regularly, but it is certainly not because of a lack of desire on my part. As we grow older, it seems more of an effort, particularly in cold weather. May I hope to see you there? Sincerely, the manager. Well, our story is disclosed in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. And I didn't plan on my wife having to leave this morning the way things worked out. It worked out for the best for the two of us, but I can be a little bit more specific since she's gone, if you promise not to mail her the tape. I was born at a very early age. I was born at home, wasn't born in a hospital. Somebody asked me why. I told them it's because I wanted to be near my mother, I suppose. And I was raised in a home that was very rigid, very regimented, very religious. Not very spiritual, but very, very religious. My parents didn't believe in a lot of things. They didn't believe in LBJ and the Great Society. They didn't believe in integration. They didn't believe in Elvis. They didn't believe in the Beatles. They didn't believe in working on Sunday or staying out on Monday. They didn't believe in Peyton Place, breaking the Ten Commandments. But at the top of the list, they didn't believe in drinking any alcohol. And I don't know that, I didn't realize till last night that I was raised in a dysfunctional family. I suspected it up until last night. I'm quite certain of it this morning. But I'm not an alcoholic today because of emotional instability or financial insecurity, or because of mental abuse and nervous breakdowns and physical exhaustion. And I'm not an alcoholic because I was a pre-adolescent bedwetter, or because when I was a toddler, my mother wouldn't let me push my oatmeal away from the table, or I sucked a pacifier too long and she set me on the potty seat backwards. I'm an alcoholic because I drank alcohol for too long, and I love the feeling that I got from it. You see, the big book tells us that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's so simple, many of us stumble over it for years. A friend that helped me get into the program said, "Ed, I hope you can do some introspective work on your past and see if you can find out the causes of your drinking." So early on, I became very interested and what people had to say about us. And I read some interesting articles and books and publications by the experts and the professionals in the field, you know, who are not like us. They can drink it like normal people, and yet they can fill scientific medical journals about why you and I do the things that we do. It gets very interesting to listen to some of these guys. One of them in some of our AA literature is quoted as said, you know, we are people who suffer from a narcissistic, egocentric core, dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent at all cost on maintaining its own inner integrity. God, I loved that when I read it. That impressed hell out of me. Another guy wrote a whole pamphlet describing how we as alcoholics have this thing called cognitive dissonance. And all he was saying was that we always think in what we don't want to think, and we never seem to be able to think what we want to think. And we always doing and being what we don't want to do and be, and we never seem to be able to do and be what we want to do and be. I could have said that in a paragraph. He wrote a book about it. Stuff like that impressed me. And I started to write home to my family. All these years, y'all thought I was drinking too much, but really what the problem is, I suffer from a narcissistic, egocentric core, dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent at all costs on maintaining its own inner integrity, and on top of that, I got cognitive dissonance, and don't you mess with me. I think I decided early on in my life that anything that my mother was that opposed to had to be fun. She didn't like it, don't like it today. If you came to our house under the influence, you wouldn't have been welcome there. It just was not allowed on the premises. And I said all that about my family, but in case this tape gets back to them, I want my parents to know I do love them very much. They've never heard me talk. I don't know if they ever will, but they're very good to me. In spite of all I said about the rigidity of my home environment, I knew that I was loved by my parents. My dad taught me how to swim when I was just 2 years old. I like never got out of that croaker sack, but cat liked to claw me to death too. But I got out. And somewhere between my seventh and eighth grade in school, I had my first spiritual experience. And it came with a pint of bourbon. The county that I was raised in was dry, and you had to go across the river in order to get alcoholic beverages. And I had a cousin that lived in Macon who was my age, and he had a friend about our age, and I was going over to spend the weekend, and they had confiscated a pint of bourbon and hid it in the basement. And that night, while the adults played upstairs, we played in the basement. And I distinctly remember us splitting that up three ways. I drank half, and they split the other half. And they poured theirs out in a little cup and walked around and sipped it like the adults. I held my breath and chug-a-lugged it as fast as I could because I wanted to find out what it felt like to be drunk. And the magic that Mary talked about happened instantaneously. It changed the way I felt. Suddenly, I felt courage. And I was real small. And I felt as big as those boys. I was proud to be from the country, even though I was now in the big city of Macon, Georgia. All the feelings of euphoria that come with it was great. I had the typical hangover the next morning, dizziness, nausea, the shakes, and I made myself a vow that I'll never ever do this again as long as I live, so help me God. Throughout my high school years, I joked earlier about being called into the ministry, but it was still while I was in high school that I made a decision that what I wanted to do with my life was go into the ministry. So I accepted a call into the ministry even when I was just a junior in high school. And being raised in a Baptist family, of course this meant no more experimenting with alcohol, and I didn't intend to. From then on, I was going to be a total abstainer. And I talk about people that did. But it just didn't work out that way. I remained dry for extended periods of time. Then I met my wife, and I decided that would be it. No more drinking, because she was raised in a good, strict home like I was. And she wouldn't understand. And so I decided not to drink any more alcohol. And I'm proud to say for the next 8 years of my life, I didn't drink any more alcohol. I drank an awful lot of cough syrup during that time, however. I found out if you got the right kind, you could drink it. Couldn't smell it quite as bad. You still staggered a little bit. But that's what I started drinking. And I was at this time in college, pastoring my first church, and we began to make what I come to realize today, those geographical cures, moving from one town, one church to the other, until it caught up with me and one church fired me. And my wife had just given birth to our fourth child in less than 5 years, and I was feeling real sorry for myself, not because of the children, but because I didn't have a job and didn't have any way to feed them. I didn't have any money to do what I wanted to do with. Somebody asked me, every time I say that, people wonder, you know, well, is he Catholic? I told them, no, I'm not a Catholic. I'm just a passionate Protestant. But I was feeling real sorry for myself, and I decided to do something nice for myself, for a change. Even though I didn't have a job, no income, had to find a place for my family to move, I bought me a ticket to go to the Macon Coliseum and watch on closed circuit TV Muhammad Ali and Larry Holmes. This was supposed to be Ali's last hurrah. He'd always been one of my heroes. So I paid $25 and got me a good ringside seat to watch it on the screen. And they had several preliminary bouts going on, and I sat down beside a guy, and we got to talking, and I noticed, you know, he was feeling no pain. And I asked him, I said, "What are you drinking?" He said, "Bourbon. Would you like some?" And I had a half a cup of Coca-Cola. It was dark inside. And the church had mistreated me. And my wife misunderstood me. And I didn't have a job. And I looked around. I didn't see any deacons. So I stuck out my cup. He opened the bottle and emptied the contents into my cup. And immediately again, it had been 8 years. But I felt that feeling again. I don't remember much about the fight. But I do remember being so anxious to get out of there that night and go get me a bottle, and I was just going to drink it for a while until I could get over this crisis. Every liquor store in town was closed by the time the fight was over, so I had to wait the next day. Being a Baptist preacher, you know, I couldn't afford to be seen in a liquor store, so I had to wait in agony all day long until it got dark enough. I put my cap on, my sunglasses, and I drove to the other side of Macon. I found a liquor store. I parked two blocks down from it. I turned around, I walked back. Here I am, about 27 years old, and I find myself in the liquor store for the first time in my life. And I was trying to be real cool about it, and I walked in, and only the clerk was there. He said, "Can I help you?" I said, "Yeah, you got any bourbon?" That's about like walking into McDonald's, won't know they got any Big Macs. He said, "Yeah, what kind you want?" I said, "Oh, what kind you got?" He pointed over on the shelf, and I said, "That looks good. I'll take a bottle of that." And he knew he had a sucker. He got a pint of Jack Daniels, and he set it down, and I paid him. And I got in my car, and I got me a Coca-Cola, and I rolled around. I did what the label says, you know, that's good sipping whiskey. So I sipped it. Also about that much, which I threw out, went home, passed out, slept it off, got up the next morning, couldn't wait till it got dark. I did it again. Same scenario, same man, same liquor store, except this time I drank every bit of it. And I went home, I passed out, and I slept it off and got up and started over again. This time we had moved back to the little town that I was raised in. It's still dry, county still dry. And I came across a buddy of mine that I hadn't seen since high school. And I had heard that he was a problem drinker. Last time he had seen me, though, I was just a preacher boy, and he didn't know I drank. And so I went to see him one day, and first thing he said to me, "My God, Ed, what are you drinking?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Don't tell me that, I smell you." And I said, "Well, I had a little bit of bourbon." He said, "Man, you better quit drinking that. Here, drink this vodka. You can't smell it." So he helped me switch brands. I started drinking vodka, and drank it rather freely because, you know, you couldn't smell it. But he forgot to tell me you still staggered, you still threw up, you still got drunk with it. That became my drink of choice. And during this time, still unemployed, just piddling around different jobs, and my wife's at home not understanding what's going on with me, and I'd had her totally convinced that the world had just thrown me a curve in life, and what I needed to do is just change denominations. I get out of the way from these Baptists, they're going to kill me. And it wasn't long after that until another church got in touch with me and wanted me to come preach a trial sermon. That's what we call them in Baptist churches, and I didn't realize you stay on trial the whole time you're there. But I went and preached that trial sermon, and the church told me they were going to vote the next Sunday, and they wanted me to go home and pray about it. And if they extended me a call, they wanted me to pray about coming. So since I was unemployed, I went home and told Ann I was sufficient to go pray about it, and I wanted her to start packing while I was praying. Sure enough, they called me, and I went there. We moved in on Thursday, and on Saturday afternoon, the chairman of the deacons came into my kitchen, sat down across the table from me, and introduced himself and said, "I'm an alcoholic." I thought, "My God, what have I gotten into?" He said, "But if I won't drink anything till the 12th day of December, I will not have had a drink in 4 years. Then it dawned on me why God had called me to that church. I was there to help that fellow. I could see my ministry shifting at that moment. He soon brought me a copy of the big book just to go along with my collection, put in my office. I thanked him. And many times, behind closed doors, I would take that book off my shelf and go back to the stories and read them. And I was always impressed by them. Some of them just bring tears to my eyes. These fellows, you know, be just down in the mouth and down and out, and then suddenly they'd come to this magnificent program and start working some steps, and then the life would change dramatically for them. That impressed me. I liked that. Nothing in the first 164 pages applied to me. Never bothered to read that. I don't know what it was that spurred off my first drunk after I was there. It didn't take much. It might have been a deacon's meeting. Somebody could have sung off-key in the choir. I don't know. About 3 months after I'd been there, I suppose, I started drinking again. And you can hide some things about alcoholism for a period of time, but you can't hide everything all the time. And this chairman of the deacon began to notice some of the traits in my life. And he knew something was wrong. And his wife was in Al-Anon, and she began talking to my wife. And one Sunday night, after church was over, he had gone home and I'd gone home. And I'd had a particularly bad weekend. He called me and he said, "Ed, I want to know what's wrong." I said, "Well, I can't tell you over the phone. Come on down to the house." Now, give me time to make up a story. He and his wife came over, and they sat down across the table with me and my wife, and he said, "Now, I want the facts. I know something's not right. Can you tell me?" I started crying, and I said, "Yes, I can. This doctor's got me hooked on cough syrup." He said, I knew it. He knew more than I thought he knew. He said, "Have you ever been to an AA meeting?" And I said, "No, don't plan to go either." He said, "Well, it might do you good and it won't hurt you." I said, "But what if somebody in the congregation finds out that their pastor went to an AA meeting?" He said, "Well, you don't have to go here. We can go anywhere. They have them all over the place." He said, we'll go up the road about 30 miles. Nobody knows you there. So to pacify him, get him off my back, I went. And I enjoyed it. I really did. I sat there among total strangers and everybody smiling. Go around the room, introduce themselves. "I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic." It got my turn. I said, "I'm Ed Arnold and I'm a drug addict." And they just listened very patiently and smiled and let me ramble on. I came back the next meeting, and this guy wasn't with me. And I learned a lot that first meeting, so I wanted them to know that the second time I got there. Introduced myself and told them I was a drug addict. After the meeting, smart-ass men, but looking back, they're pretty wise. Two fellas came to me and said, "Ed, do you have a desire to stop drinking?" I said, "Oh, no, I don't drink." He said, "Well, this program is a fellowship of men and women who have a desire to stop drinking." And he said, we're so glad you're here. If you have a desire to stop drinking," he said, "if not, there are other programs we'd like to introduce you to." I said, "Let me get this straight. You're telling me that I'm not welcome to come in here and sit in your meetings?" They said, "Not at a closed meeting. You can't come." And I said, "But y'all read every night that when anyone anywhere reaches out the hand for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that I am responsible." So I argued with them. They told me, said, "Well, we suggest you go somewhere else." I came right back the next meeting. I sat defiantly in my chair, and when it came my time, I told them, "My name's Ed Arnold. I'm a drug addict." And then I proceeded to tell them how I planned to get well, using their steps. They came to me after the meeting and said, "Ed, do you have a desire to stop drinking?" "I don't drink, damn it." Had a bottle under my seat. They said, well, we're going to have to do something about this. So they had one of them things called a group conscience meeting. And I've come to realize today that what happened was a loving God must have expressed himself in the meeting, because they asked me not to come back. So I got kicked out of the first AA group I ever went to. And now I had a head full of AA and a heart full of resentment and a liquor bottle under the seat. I was more qualified for the program than ever. And there's no more deadly a combination anywhere than a head full of AA and a belly full of liquor. When I came home, I told my wife, I said, those people have got to be Baptists. They're the biggest hypocrites I've ever seen. Here they are talking about wanting to help you, and I was reaching out to them for help, and they didn't want my kind there. I'm never, ever going back to one of those meetings as long as I live. And I meant that. That made it easier for me to drink. But it didn't make it easy for me to stay at that church. Because this guy kept seeing things about me. You know, he wondered why I wasn't home sometime 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. He wondered why I took so many business trips to Atlanta and Augusta and Columbus, Savannah. I mean, I held Southern Baptist conventions all over the country when they wasn't even meeting. And so I decided what I need to do is get away from that fella. He was really aggravating the situation. So another church gave me a call, and I went there. And I stayed at that church in Worth County for 5 years. And there I learned the meaning of the progressive nature of this disease. I continued, don't ask me how I did it, but I continued to function in my role as a pastor and as a husband, as a father, to enough degree, I suppose, to get by without my family knowing really what the problem was. My wife still think I'm drinking cough syrup. And my congregation not knowing anything. Now I was in a situation where every time I get drunk, I felt guilty, I felt ashamed, I felt embarrassed. And I didn't have the luxury of going to a bar and sitting around and drinking with my friends. I couldn't afford to be seen there, somebody telling me, or I'd run into a deacon, sure as the world. So I had to be very discreet about it, and I had to learn to entertain myself while I was drinking because I had nobody to share those moments with. One of my favorite activities was to drink on Saturday afternoon, especially during the fall of the year when college football begins. I love with a passion to hear Larry Munson call the play-by-play of a Georgia Bulldog game. If you've never ridden around drunk listening to Larry Munson describe Georgia playing Clemson, you've probably never been properly drunk. But I had my bottle and I started riding, no particular direction, just ride till it got halftime, turn around and come back and drink. And I had this little game. Soon as Larry said, get the picture now, I took me a big drink. Then at the end of the first quarter, I take a drink. Halftime, take a drink. Third quarter, take a drink. Take one at the end of the game. But you know how we are. You know how progressive this thing gets. That got to be too long a time between drinks. So I said, well, you know, it's 3rd and 15. If he throws a pass, I'll take a drink. Or it's 4th and 20. If he punts, I'm going to take a drink. Then at halftime, you got to stop and get you another bottle, and you turn around and start heading home. This was back during the years. I said, if Georgia scores, you know, I'll take a drink. This was back during the years when Georgia had the junkyard dog defense. They called them. You remember when Georgia wouldn't score about 17, 20 points a game, but if they did, they'd win because they didn't give up very many points. So I didn't get a chance to do much drinking during that time. Then they went out down here in Johnson County and recruited this guy by the name of Herschel Walker. And they gave him the football, and he started running over people in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Clemson, South Carolina, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Jacksonville, Florida, scoring touchdowns, lighting up the scoreboard, and my drinking just took off from that point right there. You know, if the truth were known, Herschel Walker's probably responsible for me being an alcoholic. And I'd come home, pass out, get up at night, start it over again. Love to ride around on Saturday night, just ride country roads, drinking, listening to music. Because on Saturday night, I could always find one of those radio stations that would play nothing but hits from the past, the 50s and 60s. And God, I loved it then, and I love it now. In case y'all hadn't noticed, music today has gone to pop. You can tell by listening to the name of some of the groups. It's no good. Motley Crue. Twisted Sister. My God, what happened to the good old simple names like Peter, Paul, and Mary? That's a good name for a trio. And I'd get my bottle, and I'd find that station, and I'd tune in, and I'd listen to those songs in the past, you know, that would take me back somewhere. But I remembered the good times when I was in high school and somebody that I was dating, and these songs would do that for me. And then the music then was, you know, much more sophisticated then than it is today. I mean, this kind of music then had substance to it. It would make you think. It was philosophical. Peter, Paul, and Mary would ask that burning question, how many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must a cannonball fly before it's forever banned? Now take me a drink, think about that. And then they'd come back on and tell you the answer. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. Answer is blowing in the wind. I thought, my God, it just blew right by me. I missed it somewhere. Little Skeeter Davis come on and sing, why does the sun go on shining? The sea rushed ashore. Don't say no, it's the end of the world, because you don't love me anymore. And I'd take a drink and just squall. I see there's a bunch of hopeless romantics in here this morning, too. I'm not the only one. I said, that's my problem. She just don't love me anymore. They had one song, though, that really touched my heart. And I'm serious about this, the words of it anyway. It's from a song called The Tracks of My Tears. People say I'm the life of the party because I tell a joke or two. Although I might be laughing loud and hearty deep inside, I'm blue. So take a good look at my face. You see, my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of my tears. And I'd drink, and I'd drink. And I'd come home, the kids and the wife for sleep. It's just a few hours before Sunday morning. This is a progressive disease. One thing I'd always told myself, that I'd never drink on Sunday. But I got out, I knew then, if I ever started that, I'd have a problem with it. But as long as I didn't have to drink on Sunday, I was okay. I worked on Sunday, you know. But my bulldog spoiled my hiding place for my liquor at home, so I had to resort to hide it in my office at the church. Usually my wife would take a shower about 10 o'clock at night. And the time I heard the shower cut on, I'd run out the back door and take the phone off the hook and run out and get my bottle that I had dropped in the bushes, take a big slug, put it back in there, and come back in. By the time she got through with the shower, I was sitting there, you know, just as calm as a May morning. She never figured out what's going on. I went running out there one night. It was about 10 degrees. I was in my drawers because I wasn't going to be out there long. And I looked in the bush where I'd laid my liquor, and it wasn't there. I thought, well, I must have been drunk, and I realized it's still under the seat. And I went out, and I looked under the seat and couldn't find it. I said, well, I reckon I put it back in my golf bag. And I opened up the trunk, and I reached down in my bag and couldn't find it. I'm about to freeze to death now. Emptied all my clubs out on the ground. I couldn't find my liquor. I run around the house to see if I could still hear the shower, and I did. I ran back around to the back door, and about that time I ran into my bulldog, and he came walking around there and had two pieces of brown paper bag hanging out both sides of his mouth. He had found my liquor bottle and just about chewed the top over. I'd like to kill me a bulldog that night. But I had to move my hiding place, and I would go down to the church, and I found that I could go in my office and pull my books up to the front of the shelf. That leave me about that much room between the books and the wall, and I could conveniently drop a fifth over behind the books. I hid it right behind the big book, by the way, because nobody ever wanted to borrow that one. So, and that's where I would continue to do my drinking. But you know how chronic, progressive this illness is, and it wasn't long before I would hold on to the pulpit, struggle through a sermon, while everybody sat out there in the congregation. You know, they couldn't wait to get started, and then they couldn't wait to get out. I got where I could tell time just by looking at the congregation. We didn't even have to wear a watch. You know, they Baptists down there, they want to start at 11 o'clock sharp and end at 12 o'clock dull. A bunch of what I call clock-eyed Baptists down there. You watch them about 11:40, they start this. By 11:45, they'll do this. By 11:50, they'll do this. Yeah, I had to make sure you let them out by 12 o'clock. You'd think they'd all make a dash to the car, and so they'd beat the Methodist down to the restaurant, but they wouldn't. They'd hang around outside another 45 minutes and talk. My God, that's when I wanted them to go home. And I'd hang around. They'd say, preacher, you go on home with your family. We'll turn these lights off. I said, no, I don't mind doing it. I got to lock up. We'll do that. No, y'all go on. I don't mind doing it. You know, it's a dirty job, but somebody had to do it. Besides, it made me look humble, too. As soon as they'd run off, I'd run back to the office and get my Mountain Dew and turn it up, count 25 swallows of liquor, throw a search in my mouth, run out in case somebody forgot something, came back, get in my car, go home, get a bite to eat, pass out, wake up at 4 o'clock, start gargling with scope, pouring the Visine in my eyes, get ready to go back Sunday night, start the whole game over again. But guilt, shame, the fear of exposure was killing me. I felt at the time that I could not share with anybody what was going on with me because, to show you how egotistical I was, I felt like I had to protect and preserve the integrity of the ministry. This was before Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart. Well, if I'd known then what I know now, I'd have been in this program a long time ago. But one of the worst fears I had was at some point, someone in my congregation was going to need me in an emergency situation, and I would be drunk. And so far, remarkably, only by the grace of God, I had been able to escape an embarrassing situation, but a situation where I was exposed. I had plenty of embarrassing situations. One night, I had just finished my bottle and settled down in my easy chair to pass on out to oblivion, and the phone rang about 10:30 at night. You know how we are. We think we can talk a whole lot better when we're drunk. I think we sound a lot better than we do. I answered the phone. This lady was on the other end crying. She said, oh, Brother Ed, I hate to call you so late at night. But I want you to talk to my husband. I said, you don't mean tonight, do you? She said, I know it's late, and I hate to ask you to come out tonight, but he needs to talk to you. I wish you'd come see him. I said, what's his problem? She said, he's drunk. And this fellow had been sober 7 years and got drunk. I knew what had happened to him, but I sure didn't want to go. I said, you don't think you can wait till in the morning? She said, no. I said, well, I'll tell you what, then probably it'd be better for him if you just go on to bed and let the two of us be alone. I didn't want her to see me like I was. I drank 2 cups of black coffee. That just makes you a wide awake drunk. Don't help sober you up at all. And I went down to the man's house, lived about 3 miles from me. And you never seen anything any more pitiful in all your life than 2 drunks together. One of them's supposed to be sober, telling the other one how to rightly relate to God and not drink liquor. And I wish I could say that I was sober as a judge when I got out and walked up his back step, but I fell out of the car. I held onto the rail and went up to his back door. And got inside. Fortunately for me, he was a little bit further along than I was. He was in the crying and the talking stage. And I sat down on the couch, and he sat down in his chair, and he began to babble and ramble on. Finally, after about 30 minutes of that, he said, Preacher, will you pray for me? I said, sure, I'll pray for you. And I started to pray. He said, wait. He got out on his hands and knees, and he crawled over to where I was at. He wanted to hold hands. Put my hands together and closed them with his and got right in my face. I thought if he lights another cigarette, he's going to blow us both to hell. I started praying. He started crying louder. The more I'd pray, the more he'd holler, yes, yes, bless him, Jesus, yes. This is agony on, you know. I just started getting into it then. And tears were just running down his face and slobber out of his mouth and snot out of his nose. And he'd come down to a point on his chin, and he took my hands and just wiped his chin. When I finished praying for him, he looked at me, and there was a gleam in his eye, had a little grin on his face, and I thought, I have just made a profound spiritual impact on this man's life. And if I live to be 120, I'll never forget what the man said. He looked at me eyeball to eyeball, and he said, Preacher, that prayer didn't mean shit to me. That hurt my feelings, and it made me mad too. I didn't say it, but I thought to myself, you old fool, I don't care if you die tonight. And on my way home, I thanked God for that eye-opening experience, because I said, now I see where I'm headed, and I don't want to get like that old fool. I know now I'll never have to drink again. And that experience, my friend, kept me sober about 2 weeks. It's a wonderful program we're in. That man hadn't had a drink since that night, and I sponsor his son today. I had another eye-opening experience when my family decided to intervene in my life. I had reached the point where I was completely out of control, suicidal, destitute of any hope, but yet inside it was all stuffed. There was nothing but a facade on the outside. A miserable wreck of a human being, an imposter, a hypocrite, if you will, with nowhere to turn. I knew what an intervention was. Heck, I had chaired one about 2 months earlier myself. Got a fellow in treatment. Carried him all the way to North Georgia. He cussed me all the way up here. And I was drunk before I got home. I chaired the intervention that got him in treatment. Here he was up in the North Georgia mountains in January, freezing his tail off, and I was at home drinking. I felt a little guilty about that, too. But I knew about these interventions. I knew how they worked. I'd done read all that stuff. And I figured when I got back from Callaway Gardens and a golf tournament that my wife was going to pull this stunt on me. I could just tell by the way she would talk to me on the telephone. See, Al-Anon got to her before AA got to me. And she picks up on this stuff real quick. I'll never forget the first meeting she went to. I was embarrassed. I wanted to go out of town. I didn't want to go to town. I said, "You learn anything tonight?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "I learned that I can't control it. Quit pouring it out." I thought, well, this ain't so bad. Next time she came back, I said, "You learn anything tonight?" And she said, "Yeah, they told me that I can't cure it. Quit nagging." I said, "Hot dog, I like this program." She came back next time. I said, "What'd you learn tonight?" She said, "They told me I didn't cause it." I said, "Darn it, I knew there was a catch to it somewhere. Couldn't be that good." The program had begun to take root with her. She decided to quit enabling. Please don't ever think that you can't help an alcoholic until they won't help. I wasn't looking for AA. She decided that she was no longer going to tell people when they'd called me and I was passed out on the bed that I was sick. She was going to tell them, "He's drunk. When he sobers up, I'll have him return your call." I was expecting this intervention. I knew how to break it up. I just knew. You know, they'd all sit around the room, they family, they'll each take turns telling me what they're going to do if I don't do thus and so, and I can't come to see them and all this other stuff. And I was just going to look my mother in the eye and I'd start crying. And I'd say to her, "Mama, of all the people in the world that I'd ever thought would have turned their back on their son, you'd have been the last one." And I'd have started crying, and Mama started crying, and I'd have busted up that intervention. But they didn't invite Mama. And I knew something was up when I got in on Wednesday, and I went on to church that night, and Ann decided she didn't want to go. And I came back, and I was expecting to see about 3 or 4 cars in the yard. And I came dragging in. There wasn't but one strange car there. I said, "Well, I guess they couldn't wait." And I went in and said a couple of friends of mine that she'd done told all this stuff about me to. And they told me that they wanted me to get help. I'm going to make this as brief as I can. And I argued with them. I done had my speech prepared. I gave them a very eloquent 30-minute exposition on why I drank like I did, and why I wasn't going to treatment, and why I was not going to AA, and how I was going to be better now because I heard Larry Gatlin the day before say that he'd always saw himself as a bad person needing to get better, but he couldn't get help until he saw himself as a sick person that needed to get well. And I said, that just really made an impact on my life, and I know now I got it together because I'm sick and I need recovery. And one of the fellows said, "That, Ed, is some of the most polished bullshit I've ever heard."
I thought, the nerve of you to talk like that in front of my wife. I vehemently refused this program. I heard my youngest boy crying in the bedroom. And I went to him, and I said, Jonathan, what's wrong? And all he could get out, you know how children get when they can't hardly get their breath, they've cried so hard. He said, you don't love me. You don't love me. And I said, son, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. You know I love you. I love you more than anything else in this world. He said, no, you don't. If you love me, this kid's 11 years old. He said, if you love me, you'd go get help. And I'm glad the theme this year at the Roundup is see and share love. Because what that little fellow was telling me in his own way is that, Daddy, we are tired of you telling us. Why don't you prove it for a change? And I've come to realize that you don't spell love to a child, L-O-V-E. You spell it T-I-M-E. And I had robbed my kids of any quality time with their dad all these years. And I wish I could say I came into this program that I was surrendered and I wanted it for myself more than anything else in the world, but I didn't. I came defiantly, but I came to prove something to that boy. I came in feeling unique. I looked at the 12 steps, and I felt like, honestly, I felt like that if Bill Wilson had known Ed Arnold, he would have had 13 steps. And the 13th would have said, in case anybody as unique as Ed Arnold ever comes around, just disregard the preceding steps. They won't work. The doctor came by with the nurse one morning. He put his arm on my shoulder and turned to her and said, I want you to meet Ed Arnold. Ed's probably going to die of terminal uniqueness. And he was right. I came here with that feeling of being different. But you showed me love. You not only shared it with me. I came to AA, and I found unconditional acceptance. I came to a place where I could sit down and talk about my worst fears. And people would nod and smile and understand. And as much as I love the church and still involved in it today, I can't get there what I get in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program that we adhere to is, and I like what one of the books of AA says, I forgot which one, I think it's AA Comes of Age, such is the paradox of AA regeneration. That paradox, it's a statement that is seemingly contradictory and opposed to common sense, and yet it works. There's no explaining a paradox. The world says, let me see it, and I'll believe it. Our program says, believe it, then you can see it. Our program says, when I face the darkness of my past, I'm given new light for my present. The paradox of AA regeneration teaches me that it is when I am and recognize my weakness that I am given strength. The program teaches me that if I want to keep what I have to give it away. Paradox. And probably the most profound thing the program has taught me, that you have to surrender in order to win. Something as simple as that. Never caught on to me. I had it up here, but I couldn't get it here. I struggled. I thought when I got hit, man, I breezed through the second and third steps with my clerical training and my theological background. I bogged down right there. Because I'd prayed 1,000 times, take this desire to drink away from me. And I prayed laying on the floor, hugging the commode, laying over a barbecue grill, on my knees, in the car, so many places, so many different postures. And I never was able to stop. And in this third step, just one little simple word, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood. All this time I've been praying for Him to take it. And I saw that the God that I understand is a perfect gentleman. He's not going to take anything from me I'm not willing to give Him. I'm going to close with a story that I heard one time. I've changed a little bit to fit my life. The story's told about a fellow that went out one night and started drinking, got drunk, stumbled out of the saloon, and inadvertently, accidentally fell into a deep, dark pit. And there came by a host of people from all walks of life with their comments and observations and suggestions about this man's pitiful plight in that pit. They said a journalist came by and said, "Sir, may I have the rights to the story of your life in the pit?" A pessimist came along and said, "Well, you could have fallen into a better pit." An optimist came by and said, "Well, you could have fallen into a worse pit." A realist came by and said, "Now that's a pit." A mathematician came along and calculated the odds that a person would fall into a pit like that. A subjective person came by and said, "I know it feels like a pit." An objective person said, "Well, it's logical that somebody would fall into a pit like that." The IRS came by and said, "Have you paid taxes on that pit?" A mortician came by and said, "Is there room for a coffin in that pit?" A geologist came by and said, "Are there any good specimens in that pit?" A biologist came by and said, "Sir, you fell into that pit because you are a pit-falling mutant, and now you'll not be able to bear any pit-falling offspring." A university professor came by and gave him a lecture on the elementary principles of a pit. A psychologist came by and said, "Tell me, how does it feel to be in that pit?" But then my favorite, a self-pitying person came by and said, "If you think that pit's, you ought to see mine." But finally, somebody came by that had been in the pit before. And they knew the feelings of desperation. And all they did just reached out their hand. And there was a time not too long ago when all hope, as I saw it for me, was gone. I felt destined and doomed to die a drunkard's death, utterly without any hope, and bring nothing but shame and embarrassment and humiliation to myself, to my family, and my congregation. And there were people from all walks of life, family and friends and professionals and experts, who came by and offered their criticism and their comments and some even their condemnation. But then one day somebody from this program came along who knew what it was like to be in that pit. And they reached out their hand and they called out and said, "Ed, take my hand. I know how you feel." And I said, "I can't see your hand." They said, "You don't have to see it. Just believe it." And when I put my hand in the hand of you people, a new dimension opened up for me. I'm going to tell you, without sounding preachy this morning, when the disciples asked Jesus, "What's the greatest commandment of all?" He said this, very simply, "The greatest commandment is man love God, love others, and love himself." And I'd always wanted this thing between me and God. I didn't want other people in my life. And you can have one of the three or two of the three and never know a thing about spirituality. But when you get that right relationship with yourself, with the God of your own understanding, and with other people, that to me is the crux of what spirituality is all about. There's an old Irish blessing that says, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. The rains fall softly upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Thank you so much.